Grandmothers. For many of us, the word conjures images of childhood and some of the best times of our lives. It speaks to preserving the culture, folk wisdom, safety, self-reliance. Grandmothers. Shakespeare cast grandmothers as very special people when he said, in Love's Labor Lost, "A child of our grandmother Eve, a female, or, for thy more sweet understanding, a woman." Our grandmother Eve, the cradle of the human species. Welcome to Remembering Our Grandmothers, a show brought to you by Mind's Eye Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm your host, Greg Willard. In the next hour, the Mind's Eye writers will treat us to images of our grandmothers in a celebration of story, poem, and essay. We'll visit a family torn by fundamental differences among generations, check in on a grandchild remembering her grandmother's last days, and share stories about the strength and determination of grandmothers. Please join us in a remembrance of grandmothers. The scene is set, and you're invited. People used to tell poet Norma Gay Pruitt that she was the spitting image of her grandmother. It's not surprising that Pruitt's first serious poem as an adult was all about her grandmother. At the time she wrote about her grandmother, she was still learning the rules of writing poetry. In Cotton Bound, she demonstrates that she was a very quick study.
Cotton Bound, for Addie Rose Smith Sublett. With some of August caught in batting, the pilled lump of palate smells the way she did. Tobacco, wood smoke, slippery shale, each layer a generation, another summer. Hot, hoot owl, heart-ripping cry, and then the whippoorwill. Cotton-bound, snapping beans on porch swing, cracking rocks out of pockets in the hills to show me pretties. Cotton-bound, you glittered one night across snowfields in Minnesota. Snow and cotton bound me up with you. Next day, they called to say you had passed on while padding a quilt just as natural. Fluid about the heart or gout, they said, but I felt you had not passed from that, but from yearning to catch old time on a line and sinker, draw him by a pincer, match his eye. You cached these crazy notions in the quilt, sunbonnet, flower sack, Sunday silk, though your berry mind was not in it, but out uprooting hens and finding speckled eggs, fretting for your 40-year-old babies, playing barefoot where the milk snakes crawl as thick as mud and big around as your ankle. About if the boogerman was real, then what? And if Jesus hung that long, or if tick fever would bring you down that year? You probably knew, 600 miles away, I grew to you like a snail to its shell, or a chameleon lizard to your well bucket, or bachelor buttons to the clay. You most likely knew my fear. This is Norma Gay Pruitt for Mind's Eye Radio.
This is Sharon Van Sluis. This is a poem written for my grandmother, Cornelia Walvoord. Memory of grandparents can arise from such huge things as summers spent at a farm, from such small physical but intangible things like a fragrance or a song, or like this poem, from a moment remembered with particular clarity. Coffee break. This is a good day. You remember my name. You point out the flitting birds feasting on thistle seeds, name them Paris atrocapilus, black-capped chickadees. Yesterday, you couldn't place me as your grandchild. Yesterday, the birds went hungry. We sit in your neat kitchen, sipping strong coffee. So good, you say. So good, you have to be quiet about it. Close your eyes and drink. It's a gift after long abstinence. Your doctor surprised you. Now he allows it. Eat what you like. It's tainted advice, I know. The 3-year disease, the slow eroding cancer, has slipped you past all remedy or rescue. I imagine him talking false and jaunty as the unlucky guard who must fetch the condemned man's last meal, nervous, urging decadence. Anything on the menu, you name it, you got it. It's an odd generosity to the body beyond reprieve, as though it were a creature, innocent and dumb, done in by bad judgment, worse company, some massive blunder. At least let it eat. The January sky is clear and aseptic. You stare out past the birds, the dark cedars, past fields trapped beneath still sheets of snow. We talk weather, a cold snap, so long until spring. I pour us another, bracing and black, and we drink what can only damage you in time. But you are without time, and the pure moment's pleasure of flavor, of body, outweighs this cup's small poison. This is Sharon Van Sluice for Mind's Eye Radio.
You're listening to Remembering Our Grandmothers on Mind's Eye Radio. Coming up, we'll take a look at grandmothers who came out of the kitchen and into the world to right the wrongs of society. I'm Greg Willard. Stay put. Mind's Eye producer Kelly Warren remembers a grandmother who was involved not just in family, but in social causes as well. Her grandmother rose up during the decade of the 30s to join with others to protest the shortcomings of a nation bereft of compassion for those in need. In this recording, Thelma sings for her family at her 90th birthday gathering.
Okay, does that have to be too very loud?
No, it'll pick you up.
There's talking, debating, and boasting about the affairs of the men, until you would think they imagine this world was created for them. They boast of their souls are too weary to look after women's affairs. We're going to vote at election. Oh dear, how it troubles my men. They think under women's direction they'll never hold office again. There's very much trouble at present throughout the political ring about foreign affairs. Discussing the silver bill question is keeping my husband out nights, but he's mad if I happen to mention the subject they call women's rights. He says I am losing my reason. At home is the place for us all. The caucus, the polls, our convention are no place for women at all. Times are fast changing, my darling. The questions discussed pretty free. Shall women stay home in the kitchen while the men are all out on a spree? He says we were never created rule or to vote, and says we'll all go to the dickens when we get to steering the boat. But he knows that he's misrepresenting. In fact, he's a thousand times said that all women govern their husbands, commencing the day they are wed. He says I'm a shoulder, a musket, and share with the men in the fights. Must swear and play cards and drink whiskey, and that's what he calls women's rights. But I don't care a fig for his growling. I'll go to the polls if I can and vote as I please. But to spite him, I'll vote for the handsomest man. We're going to vote at election. Oh dear, how it troubles the men. They think under woman's direction they'll never hold office again. My voice is not very good.
We remember our grandmothers as wise and caring, sympathetic, kind-hearted, but elder women also show us how to be determined and resolute, strong and committed. Paul Thompson sees his grandmother as much more than a keeper of the family tradition. Like Kelly Warren's grandmother, she stepped into the world and left an indelible mark.
Galloping Grandma. The Cossacks came to Grandma's town. The 16-year-old faced them down. When the chieftain saw her beauty, neglecting rapine, forgetting duty, throwing himself upon his knee, the bandit cried, "Oh, marry me." Grandma liked the man who's tough. She seized the Cossack and swept him off. With little but a knife and fork, they emigrated to New York. He got a job as a bellhop. She stitched away in a sweatshop. But it wasn't long till she grew wiser, became a union organizer. One other thing historians note, she marched up Broadway for the vote. In World War II, she pursed her lips and joined rosy, riveting ships. After the war, no time for pauses, Grandma took on a new set of causes. Grandma was there with King to oppose, snarling dogs and fire hose. Women's lib found her free. She abandoned her bra for liberty. Not looking back, she kept up the pace, was the first granny to fly into space. Age hasn't slowed her, time hasn't bent her. She's teaching computer at the senior center. This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
Listening to Remembering Our Grandmothers from Mind's Eye Radio. In a moment, we'll look in on a family divided by interracial marriage and hear about one writer's memories of a grandmother who was subject to a variety of addictions. I'm Greg Willard. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hello, Grandma, how is your granddaughter? Hello, Grandma, how is that little girl? I've been kinda out of touch, but I thought I would call her. Is she at home? Is she around the world? Is she at home? Is she around the world? Well, young man, you must mean Kathy, but I never heard her mention you. Well, no, ma'am, I don't mean Kathy. I don't hardly even know her. Well, Kathy's just fine, you know, she's still going to school. She'll be home Father's Day to see her father. Well, no, Grandma, how's your other granddaughter? You know, Grandma, how is that little girl? I've been kinda out of touch lately, but I did used to know her. Is she at home? Is she around the world? Is she at home? Is she around the world? Well, young man, you can't mean her. Why didn't you hear? Well, she got married and moved off to Chicago. Her husband's so handsome and she just loves it up there. His family owns a newspaper, an opulent disco. Whoa, Grandma, is this 924-8838? Well, yes, young man, it certainly is. Well, that's the problem, Grandma. I have made a mistake. I ain't called this number in too many years. I ain't called this number in too many years. Hello, Grandma, how is your granddaughter? Hello, Grandma, how is that little girl? I've been kinda out of touch, but I thought I would call her. Is she at home? Is she around the world? Is she at home? Is she around the world?
Grandparenting isn't limited to biological kinship. In some cases, elders take on grandparenting roles out of need or necessity. Once forged, these relationships may last through many generations, even though the individuals are from different cultures. That's what happened to writer Fran Rawl in her role as what she terms a pseudo-grandmother.
How I became an Indian great-grandmother. It all came out of the blue. After 30 years, a letter from the past saying that Krishna and Sananda Patil, my first real Indian friends, were coming to the United States again. They would be in Chicago and wanted to see us. Why Chicago? It's a long story. I had taken Sananda to the hospital in an emergency rush because she'd started to miscarry. Our international wives group had been sitting with her, as her doctor didn't want her home alone during the day. I arrived in my red Volkswagen bus just in time to meet the morning sitter coming down the stairs. Hurry, Fran. She started bleeding heavily. I called the hospital to alert them. I ran into the barber shop on the ground floor and shouted, I need two strong men to carry a woman in labor downstairs. Bring that child's seat for her to sit on. We got her down to the sliding door of the bus with me shouting to this shy Indian woman, Sananda, you have to put your arms around their shoulders. You'll fall off. She had never touched another man in her life except for her husband, so this was hard for her. I had to lift her arms and place them firmly on the shoulders. Fortunately, all went well, and they named the baby girl Vijaya, which means victory. She was almost 3 years old when they went back to India in 1973. We exchanged a few Christmas cards, but life goes on, and time passes, and things happen, and now it was 2000. And where was Vijaya, whom I had not thought about for these many years? She and her husband were both doctors and working at the University Hospital in Chicago. All four of them came to Madison on a Saturday to make the rounds of memory. The upstairs apartment, the hospital, our old house where mother and baby had come to stay for a few days. Then to our present house for dinner, me making vegetarian food much better than when the mother and baby had come earlier. After dinner, an amazing thing happened to round off the day. Glancing out the window, I announced in an urgent tone, everybody freeze! Just turn your head to the picnic table in the yard. Drinking there is a scarlet tanager, an amazing bird to have in our yard. I have never even seen one before. Well, evidently all had known what I meant by freeze, which was amazing by itself, and were obedient to this strange request. After the bird flew, I said, this is truly an auspicious occasion. which everyone agreed with. Indians believe in auspicious occasions. And maybe the Patils were not even very surprised. The younger couple went back to work. Sananda and Krishna stayed the night with us and took the bus back to Chicago. It was sweet to get a Mother's Day card from Vijaya and Sunil, but I didn't really think they would come back to Madison again. However, invitations took place and everyone was well satisfied, I thought. I forgot to mention the strains of fatherhood Krishna had been under 30 years ago. Back in India, Sananda would have gone home to stay with her mother for the last 3 months of the pregnancy. So it was another surprise to be called last year that the Patils were back in Chicago to support Vijaya in her last months of pregnancy with expected twins. Again, all went well. And I was called Grandma. It was a joy to hold three-week-old babies and take more pictures and listen to all the exciting details. They named the twin boys Akhil and Nikhil. When my husband asked what their names meant, Sunil told him, "Both mean complete." I forget if we asked Sunil what his name meant. I'm sure it doesn't mean he who gets mixed up with an American family beyond his wildest thoughts. Again, time will pass. Life will go on. Who knows what lies in the future for a new family, an old family, and a quite old granny. This is Fran Raw, recording for Mind's Eye Radio.
Your grandmother drove a sports car. She drove faster than me. She was a sometimes actress on the local theater scene. She worked in an office, but a job doesn't always define who you are. Son, when I think of your grandmother, she's driving a red sports car. She had three sons, kind of wild, and I was one of them. Whenever we try something new, she would join right in. One summer with Dad driving the boat, we all learned to water ski. The next summer she was on a Kawasaki, riding with my brothers and me. And your grandmother drove a sports car. If we raced, she'd be the winner. She played the crazy maid in the play, man who came to dinner. She worked in an office, but a job doesn't always define who you are. Son, when I think of your grandmother, she's driving a red sports car. She was a fan of the LA Dodgers, classic movies, popular books, and that little stove in the camper was her favorite place to cook. She loved to travel anywhere with Dad and us kids. And you know I sing all the time because your grandmother did. And your grandmother drove a sports car. She drove faster than me. She was a sometimes actress on the local theater scene. She sat at a desk all day long to get money to pay the rent. But son, when I think of your grandmother, she's driving a red Corvette. This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
The relationship among generations is sometimes strained by children who step outside the bounds expected of them by their parents. When that happens with adult children, the consequences can be devastating, as we see in writer Evie Thompson's skit, The Grandma Letters.
They were all there in Green Bay, at Grandma and Grandpa's house, all my aunts and uncles, all of our family, except my sister Marilyn. Marilyn wouldn't have gone if she received a gilt-edged invitation, which she didn't. She'd married a black man and got everyone's passion up. In the middle of the festivities and out of nowhere, Grandma turned to Mom and said,
God never meant for the coloreds and the whites to commingle. It's not natural.
Well, they're in love.
This is not right. Your child is not doing right. If you had disciplined Marilyn properly, this never would have happened.
Marilyn was determined. Nothing could have changed her mind. We tried sending her off to Florida to forget him, but she came back 6 months later, more determined than ever.
What Mom wasn't telling Grandma was about the night Dad beat Marilyn and she'd walked off into the dark. Mom and I were so afraid she'd walk down into the lake and drown herself.
You should disown her. That'd teach her. Strong measures. That's what's needed here.
You never understood me when I was young, and you don't understand now.
Maybe we should disown you if you won't let her go. What do you think it's going to be like when those little black babies start arriving?
I can see I'm not welcome here. I won't stay where I'm not welcome.
Mom hustled us out the door. It was very silent in the car during the long drive home. Some months later, Mom and Grandma appeared to have reconciled their differences, or at least formed a rough truce. Grandma came to our house to visit, and she and I had some good talks. After that, we wrote to each other, and I continued to write even after I went off to college. I learned a lot about her that I hadn't known, and I came to love getting letters from her.
The zinnias are doing well. The rabbits chewed up the sweet peas. I'm going to have to put up some fencing.
And I'd write about college, things like, this book, Tom Jones, is so long, I don't think I'll ever get through it. Then one day, Grandma wrote asking about my sister Marilyn. Boy, was I glad to see that. Maybe this will finally heal the family rift. All that threatening about disowning my mom if she didn't disown my sister. So I wrote all about Marilyn's little boy who was just beginning to walk, about Marilyn's husband who had just completed law school, passed the state bar exam, and was starting to practice with another African-American lawyer. I poured it all into a long letter to Grandma and put it in the mail. Surely Grandma would change her mind about Marilyn and her family. The next time I went home, I was bursting with the news. But Mom and I always had good talks when we did the dishes, so I waited until then. Mom, Grandma wrote wanting to know all about Marilyn.
Oh, no!
Oh, but it was good. I think she wants to be friends with her again.
Grandma grew up in the South. There's not a chance in the world that she'll accept this. Her curiosity must have gotten the better of her. She knew I wouldn't say a word to her about Marilyn. So she snuck behind my back and went through you.
No, it wasn't like that, Mom. Not at all.
You haven't written to her, have you? Well, have you? How could you? How could you go behind my back like that?
But, Mom... I knew there was no use arguing with Mom when she got like this. I wanted to disappear. I stopped writing to Grandma. And I still don't like writing letters to this day. A lot of years have passed since then, and things are a little easier for people getting into mixed marriages. But not enough. Not nearly enough.
As memory burnishes our mental portrait of grandmothers, they may attain a larger-than-life stature. Their lives, however ordinary in the actual experience, become almost mythical in remembering years later. That's the case with Guy Thorvaldsen's recollections of his grandma Olga.
My grandma Olga had a pretty addictive nature, so thankfully she only started drinking in the last 2 or 3 years of her life. She was in her early 80s, but the rye that she drank straight from small, clear glass jelly jars made her young and giddy. The stories that followed were almost always about her heady days as a young and independent woman, first living and working in Bergen, Norway, then across the ocean as an immigrant maid for a wealthy New York family. On her days off, her favorite pastime was to stroll through Central Park, watch people sailing small boats on the pond, and in the winter she enjoyed skating on that very same pond. I heard a lot of Grandma's stories while in my early 20s, stopping in her apartment for a lunch of Norwegian pancakes or a plate of open-faced anchovy and egg sandwiches. She was a slight, sinewy woman, hunched over from years of factory work, though judging from fading photographs on her dingy apartment walls, yellowed with cigarette smoke, even when Grandma Olga was young, she was no beauty. A thin, black-haired, bony Norwegian, with sallow eyes and nose like a crooked stick. Grandma Olga's various addictions were stuff of family legend. First was her dependence on coffee, straight up in black, a brimming potful brewed each morning for at least half an hour, until every speck of flavor and caffeine was decanted from the coffee grounds, then poured into four or five teacups waiting on the shelf above her sink, a lineup of pure caffeine for the rest of the day. Next to the cups sat the 500-count bottle of Bear aspirin, perhaps when mixed with the coffee induced a combination sort of high. A side benefit of Grandma's coffee habit was that the resulting slew of empty Maxwell House cans were filled weekly with homemade chocolate chip cookies for us grandchildren. Then there were the Lucky Strike cigarettes, at least a carton a week. We have more than one family photo of Olga not only with one cigarette in hand, but two, the roached end of the former, ready to light the latter. One or two matches a day was all she needed. The tips of her fingers were leathery, nicotine-stained, a dark brownish yellow. On our occasional trips back to Norway, one suitcase was filled with clothes, the other with Lucky Strikes. On the way back, the lucky bag was filled with spekachut, a densely salted meat. Her diet, when she would eat at all, was equally steeped in habit. Potatoes, always. Green beans from a can. Fish whenever we would bring her some. Or stringy meat flavored in a pound of butter-soaked blackened onions. Once on her plate, the meal was first covered in a snowy blanket of salt, then blackened like soot by an equal amount of pepper. But sadly, I never got to witness Grandma Olga's most serious addiction, which was to my grandfather, or Daddy, as she used to call him. Like many other new immigrants, Olga took up residency at the home of a family friend in Brooklyn, and it was in that house that she fell in love with Goodman Gatland. Though Goodman was no stranger to her, having grown up just down the fjord from her in Norway. Pictures of him show an upright, solid-looking, dark-haired man in gold-rimmed glasses. And, according to my mother, their love for each other was manifest in a never-ending conversation. Each day, Goodman would arrive home from his carpentry work, and he and Olga would sit down at the kitchen table and begin their conversation over cigarettes. In fact, one of my mother's strongest childhood memories is during the war, standing for hours on lines, clutching tobacco coupons to feed her parents' habit. Olga and Goodman had only two children at a time when most other immigrant families, especially in our clan, had four, five, six or more. I suspect that one reason for this was that Olga had not a hint of childbearing hips. I recall dancing polkas with her at the Sons of Norway dances, my arm around her thin, tense body, her wiry hands latched onto my wrist and shoulder, as she stiffly dragged me around the dance floor. There was not a soft spot on her body. The second reason for not having more kids, I suspect, had to do with the fact that Olga and Goodman loved each other too much, and consequently, my mother and her sister often found it hard to get their parents' attention. I never met my grandfather. He died from a brain tumor at the age of 56, 5 months before I was born. Afterwards, the doctors conjectured that the seed of the tumor had probably begun 25 years before when he struck his head and almost died in a construction accident. It was also the year Olga and Goodman first started dating. Perhaps on some level, Olga and Goodman both knew their days were numbered, and their 25 years of enraptured conversations was them making sure all was spoken before Goodman passed on. So at 50 years old, her husband gone, Olga went to work. First in a bakery, then in a factory, hand-soldering circuit boards for transistor radios. She loved her factory work, mostly because it was simple, perhaps addictive, and she could sing old Norwegian songs all day, and nobody minded. I miss Grandma's wry-induced memories. She seemed to use the alcohol like a hot air balloon, flying back to the free and singing girl who happily and confidently walked the streets of Bergen and then New York. During those afternoons, I also spoke of my own hopes and dreams, and unlike most adults who balked at my long hair and hippie headbands, Grandma listened carefully. But now, looking back on those times in Grandma's kitchen, I can imagine that perhaps she was often not there with me at all, but rather returning to another kitchen table, in Brooklyn, sitting across from Goodmund, ignoring the children, their cigarette smoke rising upwards like sweet sighs, both addicted to the familiar rhythms of each other's voices, sounding out the language of love. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
This is Remembering Our Grandmothers on Mind's Eye Radio. Coming up in the next portion of our show, we'll check out the similarities and differences we find in grandmothers, visit a grandmother in her workaday world, and see how a grandmother's character can be reflected in a single physical feature. I'm Greg Willard. We'll be back in a moment. Stick around, won't you? Most of us see both similarities and differences as we remember our maternal and paternal grandmothers. As children, we focus sharply on the unique characteristics that may unite and divide our elders. Esther Cameron found some striking similarities when she wrote about her grandmothers.
We inherit many things from our grandparents: genes, heirlooms, family traditions, sometimes talismanic connections to the past that help us to hang on to a sense of what we are. This poem is about such connections. The number 14. Like everyone, I had two grandmothers, but mine were both 14s. My maternal grandmother was born on February 14th. My paternal grandmother was born on July 14th. My maternal grandmother's middle name was Valentine. She was a loving couple's only child. She had 7 suitors, one of whom committed suicide for her sake. Another kept coming round after her marriage, till her husband told him to keep away. Her oval-framed photograph hangs in my mother's room. Doll perfect features full of spirit and sweetness. I hope I have made one verse with a lilt like the tilt of her head. My paternal grandmother's name was Jessie. Her features were regular, but she was thin. As a young woman, she'd studied piano in Germany and met someone her father wouldn't let her marry, and was discontented ever after. When I knew her, she looked like an urban version of the woman in American Gothic. Whereas my maternal grandmother, after a stroke, had gotten very heavy, though her upswept white hair and silk dresses were still elegant. She was affectionate, yet I shied away from her. My paternal grandmother was not affectionate. She had a way of taking you along with whatever she was doing while conveying that whatever she did was very important. She was the first person ever to survive to old age with Addison's disease. She took protein at dinner and gave herself shots. An astrologer once told me, "Your Venus is in Libra, your Aries is in Mars. That means you're very clear about what you like and don't like." I write a lot of poems with 14 lines. I write a lot on the 14th day of the lunar month, when my Valentine's Day grandmother and my Bastille Day grandmother send their currents from opposite ends of the world, and I dance in the middle. I'm Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
Life's most ordinary activities often bring vivid memories of grandmotherly chores, cooking, cleaning, washing clothes. Poet Kathy Miner remembers in particular the sensory images she once perceived in her grandmother's kitchen, watching the weekly stint at the ironing board play itself out.
My grandmother lived 1,000 miles away when I was growing up. In the summers, after my youngest brothers were born, she would make the trip from Connecticut to Wisconsin and stay with us while my mother took temporary work. She taught us many things. This is just one of them. Ironing it out. Like the honey locust sweetness signaling the end of school, the scent of heated cotton opens a tunnel in time, and I slide down through 40 years until I am a child watching as my grandmother labors over a padded wooden board. Perspiration beading her forehead, blue veins showing in her lower lip, ankles swollen over the tops of her sensible black shoes, she works her way through the rumpled pile in my mother's wicker basket. She will not be content until it is emptied, the task completed for another week, the cycle begun again. Under her practiced hand, all the wrinkles disappear. The pleats, the ruffles, the collar points, the hand embroidery, all are made smooth and fine. Pride in doing it well, Kathleen Mavornin. That's what matters, whatever the job you're called to do. In our square, old-fashioned kitchen, with the strawberry wallpaper and the red linoleum countertop and the crabapple tree outside the window, she works, she teaches, I learn, we love. Now, sucked back up into the vortex of time, I am spit out as a middle-aged woman with a blue vein showing in my own lower lip, my ankles emancipated by Birkenstocks, and grandchildren of my own just beyond the horizon. Standing in my green-dappled sewing room, using a Teflon-soled steam iron with a self-clean setting and an automatic shutoff, I smell hot cotton. I remember. For Mind's Eye Radio, I'm Kathy Miner.
Physical features can also revive memories of a time spent with a grandmother. In just such a way, Writer Dick Radke remembers a particular trait that keeps his grandmother forever bright in memory.
When I was about 10, she'd call me to help grind some coffee. She'd take my hand, even though I was much too old for that sort of thing, and we'd climb the stairs to the attic landing where the coffee grinder was bolted to the wall, a dour mug with a black handle. I'd turn that handle, and Grandma would place a tin cup under its mouth. As the ground spilled into the cup, the staircase swelled with an aroma of Central American rainforests, East Indian jungles, high African plateaus. As Grandma tamped the ground coffee down in the cup, I looked at her hands. Grandma hands. Creased and rough, yet poised to perform 100 marvels. Large as a man's hands, they shook the grate in the kitchen wood stove, broke eggs for paper-thin apple pancakes, threaded a needle and darned a sock so that you could barely feel the bump in the heel of your shoe, dug carrots out of the vegetable garden planted close by the garage. All angles and corners, Grandma's hands were made for shaking rag rugs out the back door and cradling a mixing bowl in the crook of her arm, then flailing away at the batter. Those used and useful hands worked 60 years in the kitchen, garden, laundry, keeping things in order, keeping the world in time. They showed the scars of a life of labor, thumbnails creased down the middle, thickened and lined, and long since turned leather brown. She'd lay her hands upon the table next to her cup, a festival of rose-patterned china, surrounded in the next moment by rough, formidable fingers. I remember the little finger of her right hand formed a V when she laid her hands on the kitchen table, involuntarily pointing at something in the corner. That finger stood out from the rest of her hand as though it felt superior to its partners, declaring its unique importance. Grandma's hands tied bows in the wreath on the front door at Christmas and took Grandpa's hand to dance around the hall to tunes from the Victrola. They showed me how to shuck corn and how to fold a newspaper to create a tricorn sea captain's hat. She'd put her hands upon her knees to give herself a boost up the attic stairs, then ask for my hand to help her up. While she pinned lacy curtains onto the 1,000-needle stretching frame to dry, I settled onto the cracked leather fainting couch and pawed through her collection of buttons, turning their curves between my thumb and forefinger. My favorites were the big brass discs with eagles stamped on their faces, wings spread and arrows clutched in their claws. When she'd finished at the curtain stretcher, she'd come and sit next to me in the hot, dry, rarefied air of the attic and talk. Mrs. Schmidt had a goiter. The Jaskulskis across the street went to Holy Ghost Catholic Church, but they were nice people anyway. Baker Charles Zack had an operation on his gallbladder. She'd swipe at a cobweb with the rag she carried in the pocket of her apron, and we'd fall silent for a while. Then she'd take my hand in hers and give me a little squeeze. I took it as a sign that we were best friends. More than half a century later, I remember those strong, rough, worn, liberating hands. Grandma hands. This is Dick Radke for Mind's Eye Radio.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to Remembering Our Grandmothers from Mind's Eye Radio Collective of Madison, Wisconsin. Kelly Warren is our producer with help from Dick Radke. Contributing writers include Esther Cameron, Kathy Miner, Norma Gay Pruitt, Dick Radke, Fran Rahl, Lynn Patrick Smith, Evie Thompson, Paul Thompson, Sharon Van Sluice, and Kelly Warren. Original music by Barbara Chusett. If you'd like a copy of this show, or you'd like more information about Mind's Eye Radio, log on to our website at www.mindseyeaudio.com. We welcome your comments on this and other Mind's Eye shows. Send your comments to www.mindseyeaudio.com. We'll be reading selected mail on the air as part of future programs. I'm your host, Greg Willard, leaving you with the words of poet Margaret Abigail Walker. My grandmothers were strong, They followed plows and bent to toil. They moved through fields sowing seed. They touched earth and grain grew. Until next time, best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio.